I'm Gregory Berg. Here in southeastern Wisconsin, we are experiencing one of the wettest springs on record. And it got me thinking about water and the importance of water in our world and in our daily lives. And it brought to mind this really interesting morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. Enjoy. This morning show interview was recorded back in 2010. It concerns one of the most critical issues confronting humankind, access to clean water. In the book Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization, author Stephen Solomon examines how this issue has played out in very important ways over the course of human history. He examines, for instance, how access to water was critical in the rise and fall of ancient Egypt, in the fortunes of the Roman Empire, in ancient China, and in other cultures and civilizations as well. Stephen Solomon is a journalist who has written for the New York Times, Business Week, The Economist, Forbes, and Esquire, a frequent commentator on NPR's Marketplace, the author of a previous book called The Confidence Game. Again, this book is titled Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization, published by HarperCollins.
The book took me about 7 years in all to research and write. But in a sense, it also is the accumulation of a lot of travels and work done over a lifetime. I mean, I've traveled to many parts of the world and looked at many of the water infrastructures in previous travels, as well, of course, as this one. But the truth is that in every era of world history, the societies that have been prosperous have always had water infrastructures that have served their needs. And in some eras, when great water breakthroughs have been made, it's been closely associated with the rise of great powers and the superseding of others, and therefore the decline of others, and also great turning points in civilization. Just take, for example, the agricultural revolution in the very beginning of what we call civilization, which arose in Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, from the harnessing of rivers for large-scale irrigation. Or fast forward to our own era and the Industrial Revolution, which, what was the great seminal invention of that era was the steam engine, water in another form. There was Rome and its aqueducts, and there have been canals that have been very important, from China's Grand Canal to our own Erie Canal, Panama Canal, Suez Canal, and the great challenge even of our modern era, which in a sense sets the stage for today's global scarcity crisis, which was the giant dams, the multipurpose dams starting with Hoover that provided massive amounts of hydroelectricity and irrigation water. That became the basis of the Green Revolution that really transformed world society and allowed the population of the world to grow from about 1 billion people to our current 6.5 billion people. And as I say, that's the bit of the genesis of the idea behind this whole problem that we're running into anyway, because water has been such an important economic input, a vital economic input, not just for agriculture, but for all things that we do, that it has grown twice as fast as world population in the 20th century. And hence, today we are extracting more from nature in the way that we use it than we can actually sustain for our current population, much less the 9 billion that we're becoming. So
over the course of these 7 years, as you set about writing this amazing account of water and its profound effect on all of these different civilizations you just mentioned, and more through the course of a long history, I mean, did you yourself kind of work chronologically, or what sorts of things did you seek out? And in some cases, are you plowing new ground in terms of looking at civilizations that we've examined a lot before, but not necessarily through this particular lens?
Yeah, exactly. I chose to do a very conventional world history. That is, look at go to the classic historical textbooks, sort of condense them, if you will, into this story to tell to be the backdrop for my narrative, but to do it in a way that looked at through the water lens and say, what roles did water play and how important were they in shaping the history of these great high points of human civilization and history? And oddly enough, I found that almost in all the histories that I was reading, water was always a prominent part of every historian's story, but they were always telling a narrower story, a particular story. So this is the first book ever to sort of pull it all together, and in a sense you're getting a sweep of many great historians' views, you know, in this book. It was actually not so hard to... didn't require any great genius on my part to do it, just a matter of pulling the threads together, if you will. Hmm. But what the point of it was to also to try to extract certain lessons from that history and then use that to help illuminate our current global freshwater crisis, which really puts us into a whole new era and a new turning point in both water and world history.
Although this is mostly... a historical book and, in a sense, a sociological book and to some extent, a scientific book. I mean, it blends all those things together, but it's in a sense, mostly history and economics and that kind of thing. I really appreciated how you summarize water itself from sort of a scientific perspective to help us understand kind of its unique place in the natural order. Water, which you call... has always been man's most indispensable natural resource. Just tell us a little bit about some of the qualities of water itself, which make it so extraordinarily important beyond the obvious.
Right, and it seems like such a simple molecule, and it is. But it is the molecule that is able to mix with every other molecule and change and transform them. It absorbs large amounts of heat before it heats up itself, which means that when we have water in the soils, it prevents us from facing extremes like we have in the deserts, which don't have water in the soil, or absorbing heat from the atmosphere in the ocean, so that our planet doesn't become like Venus. And that's been a great help in the global warming issue these days. It also has an ability, a very sticky ability, to stick to other molecules and climb against, defy gravity. It climbs through up to tree roots, up all the way up to the leaves. It climbs up our veins and our blood. I mean, we are 70% water, just like the Earth is. It is us. So there are, and it has other extraordinary capacity elements as well, and including being in a liquid, solid and a gaseous form on the planet, the only major element to do that. And most importantly, in a way, is that it is the only really self-renewing natural resource. It does so through the natural process of evaporation and precipitation. And it is that water that recycles in a cleansed form that replenishes our rivers, our lakes, and makes human civilization possible. And it's actually a very finite amount and a very tiny amount of water that we're talking about here. But every civilization in world history has lived off that tiny amount until now. Until now, we are facing that we are actually extracting more from nature than nature can replenish.
You write, water is the planet's universal solvent. Its extraordinary capacity to saturate, dissolve, and mingle with other molecules to catalyze essential chemical reactions makes it Earth's most potent agent of change. It is water that conveys the life force of nutrients and minerals upward against gravity to crops, treetops, and the blood vessels of human beings. Water that enabled the earliest forms of life to evolve and help create the planet's oxygen-rich atmosphere. Water's anomalous property of becoming less dense and more expansive as it freezes helps fracture rocks to promote geologic change, and fortuitously means that an insulating layer of ice forms first over the top of lakes and rivers, protecting the water-living creatures below. I mean, and that's not even the whole list
of
all of the reasons for which we should be grateful for water.
And I would say this, too. I mean, people are surprised when I ask people, how much water do you think you consume personally each day? You know, they are always shocked. The answer is 1,000 gallons of water a day. It's not that we drink 1,000 gallons. We drink the couple of gallons that we need, you know, to hydrate ourselves. But in the food that we eat, there is a hamburger, a half a pound hamburger takes 800 gallons to produce because the cattle have got to eat all that the grain and such to be able to grow to that size. A glass of milk is 200 gallons. And then you think of something that we use. I mean, it's embedded in semiconductors and our chips, and our computer uses something on the order of 2,000 gallons of water to produce a tiny little semiconductor chip. In energy, we don't even think about energy and water, but they are completely interlinked. We spend more water, we use more water in this country, in the United States, than we do for agriculture. We use 40% of our water to produce thermoelectricity, mostly for cooling the power plants. So there's an awful lot of water embedded in the things that we're using, and we don't think about it.
Absolutely. Maybe we could talk a moment about this, what you were just touching on a minute or two ago, about what on the surface seems strange. That is, on the one hand, we have this superabundance of water on this, which is called the water planet, and yet it is a tiny amount of all that water that, in fact, is immediately accessible to us and easily accessible to us. Just paint that picture of what makes water relatively scarce and now tremendously scarce.
Sure. The reason the first of all, 97.5% of the water is salt water and therefore usable by us and for plant life, etc. Of the fresh water, the 2.5% that is fresh, almost all of it is locked away in polar ice caps and in glaciers, and then there's a huge amount that is underground, some of it very, very deep in the bowels of the earth, mixed in with the rocks and the dirt and the rest of it, which leaves really a very tiny fraction of far less than 1% of the water on the planet, a fraction of 1%. That is actually circulating on the surface or the near surface in the groundwater that we have access to. And a lot of it, frankly, it's unevenly spread around the world, which is part of the answer to the second part of your question. You know, some countries, like the United States, actually have a lot of water. It's not always well placed for everybody. I mean, there are parts of the country that need more than we have. But depending on also your relative populations, you know, is there enough? Now, there are parts of the planet, like the Middle East, that have run out of water to provide the food, for example, that their populations need since the 1970s, and they've been increasingly food dependent. There are going to be 3.6 billion people living in countries that cannot feed themselves because they do not have enough water to grow the food they need in the next 15 years, and that's going to include giant countries like India, large countries like Pakistan, and even possibly China. China, which with its large population, is actually one of the water-scarce countries of the earth, and it is an Achilles heel of its juggernaut growth. It has one-fifth the amount of water per person than we do, and an awful lot of it is so terribly polluted they can't even use it for agriculture. So what has, in a sense, happened, you've got to look at water both overlaid about where, how it is distributed on the planet, you know, where there's an abundance and where there are shortages by natural distribution. And then you got to look at the population pressures people trying to utilize it. There's a third level, which some countries are beginning to address now, is how efficiently do you use the water you got? Because if we used all the water very efficiently, very productively, there would be enough, even for the populations that we have today. But everywhere, including in our country, we are very wasteful and inefficient in our practices in the use of water.
And what you're telling us is that we cannot afford to be, no longer.
Exactly. Look, America has, there's a choice that is interesting. We could be, and we are, a water superpower. We could be a mini Saudi Arabia, however, of water for a very water-thirsty world, requiring all of the food and the industrial goods that are water intensive to make, if we accelerated a process of improving the productive use of the water that we've got. Otherwise, we could just choose to sort of slim down a little bit, and that's the course that we've been mostly taking. But But there are countries that have been pushed to it, like Australia and in Israel, that have, that really use their water far more productively than we do. So there is a model for us to follow and embrace. It would immediately increase our economic growth, because water is one of the most important economic inputs in our society, and it would immediately also elevate our international standing, because we would be producing the vital goods that this rest of this world is going to be desperate to have on a reliable basis in the next 15 years. But our leaders are completely asleep to it, and it will require very difficult reforming of certain sectors of our economy, particularly the agribusiness sector. Mm.
You, in describing this desperation, write this in, I believe, the prologue to the book: an impending global crisis of freshwater scarcity is fast emerging as a defining fulcrum of world politics and human civilization.
Absolutely. Water is overtaking oil as the world's scarcest critical natural resource. And just as oil reshaped the history of the 20th century, water is defining the geopolitics, the environment, the economics, and the everyday life of the 21st century. But water is actually more important than oil. It's indispensable, as you alluded to before, because you can't grow food with oil and you can't drink oil. So two major things are happening. The first is that we are taking so much water out of our ecosystems at the current time that many of them are on the verge of collapse. There are something like 70 major rivers around the planet that no longer reach the seashore, and their deltas have drying up. Half the wetlands are gone, and I could go down the list. But the political side of it is that the world society is polarizing into water have and have-nots, and that's a rather explosive situation that is playing out in countries, for example, like Pakistan, where we have invested, you know, so much blood and treasure, really, in that country over there, and they have an enormous water crisis. In fact, our government just committed $7.5 billion to try to help Pakistan in the next 5 years. Half of that is focused on water projects, irrigation, hydropower, and they've got a terrible problem in that the Indus River, which is their lifeline river and supports all their agriculture, is shrinking by about one-third because its source is in one of those Himalayan glaciers that are melting very quickly under the global warming problems. And they're, at the same time, their population is growing 30%. So here you have a nuclear-armed state. Taliban, you know, is besieged. You know, it's critical to our interests in Afghanistan and the entire Middle East. And it's facing an enormous water crisis. That's going to rebound on us if we don't help them meet that.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Stephen Solomon, and we're talking about his book called Water: The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. Let's step back at least for a few minutes from the crisis of the present day and give our listeners some sense of the enormous historic sweep that is represented by your book. Your book takes us back to the very dawn of civilization and to the very important role that water played, not only in the rise of the first human civilizations, but in the very earliest empires. First of all, just say a word about how we can know what we know about the ancient world and about water's role in it.
Well, I went back, of course, I did not do, you know, decipher hieroglyphics or anything of that sort, but there have been people that have done that, and I've relied on their work, of course, to do that. There are ample historians, ample coverage of these periods. They've been studied. Some of it is archaeological research, of course, where languages haven't been deciphered going way back, but once you start to reach the Roman world and the Chinese world, there's an awful lot of written material that people have gone through. So that's that and the artifact record are the two great sources. So going back a little bit farther, I'll just to give you a couple of examples. I mean, to take the Nile, the Nile is a great river just because it floods exactly at the right time for the agricultural, in harmony with the agricultural season, and its floods recede at the right time as well. But the only thing that happens on the Nile that is difficult to figure out is the size of the Nile floods. And there is an amazing correlation between the ebb and flow, if you will, of the Nile floods over a long period of time and the political stability and unification of the Egyptian ancient civilization. This carried forward all the way to the modern times until the 19th century, that the population levels of the Nile Valley and the Delta always swung within about 2 million to about 5 million people, depending on whether the floods were good or whether they were poor. And when they were poor, the region became ungovernable and would fracture and break up, failed states, just as we're facing the potential of today in other parts of the world because of water scarcity. And when there was good Nile floods, the governments were able to become more centralized, were stronger, and the empires achieved their greatest stature. That was sort of the most simple template, if you will, of the importance of water and its meaning for political society. But it's also true in our own era. I mean, if you think about it, think about building these very large. There are 45,000 giant dams now built of the Hoover type around the planet. Half of them, by the way, in China, who's still going strong. But to build such projects, you know, that really went along with strong centralized governments. I'm not going to say causality, you know, one causes the other, but they mutually reinforce each other. So you begin to see trends where strong governments tend to be the ones that are building these epic water projects. In China, for example, the Grand Canal, it's 1,100 miles long, about going from New York to Florida, if you will. In the early 7th century, this was completed in a matter of 20 years. There had been other canals, so they linked it all together. But you know, something like 5 million people perhaps even died on building this project. I mean, the government marshaled tremendous forces. But this became suddenly an artery that linked up northern China and southern China, two regions that never before had easy transport between them. And suddenly all the resources of both regions, one very, very arid but very fertile region in the north and the rice-growing region in the and wet region in the south but less good resources, came together. And that became the springboard for this great medieval society that China had for several hundred years. I mean, they were way advanced beyond anything Europe could imagine. And at a certain point in history, China, as we know, famously turned inward in the 15th century. And that also correlates to the completion of a new Grand Canal, when they figured that they could meet their food needs without having to go out and sailing along the seashores, which are less reliable and pirate-infested waters. And they turned their back on the world when they could have had. They had ships that were sailing the Indian Ocean that could have easily come to Europe and the United States, and done all the things that Europe did in the voyages of discovery 80 years later. So water played a role in history that way as well.
Back to Egypt for a moment, as you describe the remarkable, in a sense, gift to Egypt that the Nile was. One of the things you say about the Nile is that it is a rare two-way navigable river.
Yes, indeed.
And what does that mean?
Most rivers, take the Mississippi, for example, you know, you can only sail in one direction if you don't have, because the current, you know, goes one way and it's very hard to go upstream. But the Nile has winds that very strongly blew in the opposite direction of its current. So they were able to go in both directions with sail power on the return. And obviously some oars as well. But that made political cohesion a lot easier. And if you can control the main river of a nation, you pretty much can control what happens politically internally. I'd like to, maybe our your listeners might be interested in the United States because.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say one more other thing about Egypt, and then let's move to the United States. At some point in the book, in describing some of the remarkable navies which roamed the Mediterranean Sea, you draw a contrast between some of those early naval powers, maritime powers, and Egypt, which you say, in some sense, sort of shyly stuck to its own coast. And one maybe has the sense that because the Nile itself gave the Egyptians so much, that also had probably some bearing in them not feeling much in the way of necessity or compulsion to roam the seas of the world the way some of these other early civilizations did. I mean, it's not that they couldn't have developed the technology to do so,
right.
But in a sense, the very nature of the Nile itself meant that it wasn't necessary for them to do so in the way that it was necessary for other civilizations.
Absolutely, and this is sort of the inverse principle of necessity being the mother of invention. They had it all right in their backyard. Just as we have, I was trying to make, if you want to close the loop a little bit, the United States has vast, you know, water resources and a modest population, and we can just slim down and get by. We don't have to make these great productivity increases in the way we use water, the way, let's say, Australia or Israel does, but it behooves us to do it. Otherwise, we do risk becoming an inward-looking society the way China did or the way Egypt was in the face of the opportunity to look outward and expand.
Hmm. Which, of course, in your view and probably the view of a lot of people, would be a grave mistake on our part.
I think it would be a grave mistake from our own domestic growth standpoint. I think it would be a grave mistake from our international standing standpoint.
Could you, I found this very interesting, contrast, for instance, what we have just described in terms of ancient Egypt versus the civilization which sprang up in the region of Mesopotamia, which you describe as a far more complicated hydrological environment. And so what sprang up there was different as well.
Absolutely. In Mesopotamia, the rivers did not flood at the right season. In fact, they flooded at the wrong time. So it required much more complex water engineering to store water, to build the dams, to contain it and release it when you needed it. As well, the river was not a nice, tame, beautiful river that flowed always within its channel beside the flooding itself. But the Euphrates, for example, would often change course and leave cities just high and dry. The famous city of Ur, at some point in history, just suddenly lost its water source because it flowed in, and after a flood, it went and made a new channel and flowed in another direction. The Yellow River in China also did that famously, and when it did, the Chinese civilizations would fall. The other problem that Mesopotamia had, and that all irrigation societies have, is that when there is intensive irrigation, it brings various minerals to the surface, and particularly salts begin to contaminate the surface soils. Sometimes there's waterlogging problems as well. And that those regions become less and less able to, the ground becomes less fertile, and they're unable to sustain the type of agriculture that they had had before. So what you see is people eventually shifting to salt-resistant crops like barley as opposed to wheat, and then finally of having to abandon the fields and try to move upriver or to some other newer location. And the other thing that you see in Mesopotamia and elsewhere in the world, in every civilization, is that power has always tended to migrate upriver. As soon as the capacity to control the water flowing downstream, technological capacity, falls into the hands of the people upriver, they gain the upper hand in a political and military sense. And so you also see that migration throughout Mesopotamia as well. And we're seeing it today in the same exact region where Turkey has become the regional superpower, controlling the fates of the downriver states Syria and Iraq. We've put a lot of blood and treasure into Iraq, and yet it's the water from Turkey that is going to be one of the critical elements, whether they succeed or not as a society going forward.
Hmm. We have already mentioned the nation of Pakistan, and that brings to mind one of the most intriguing passages in your book, in which you describe what until the 1920s was essentially an entirely lost and forgotten civilization, which existed along the banks of the Indus River in that region, sort of bordering modern-day India and Pakistan. Tell us how such a thing can possibly be true.
Well, there are many mysteries in this world. I don't know the answer. I've got the answer how it could be true, but these things get buried under the ground, you know, and people don't think about them. I mean, we think about the 19th century was this great era of archaeological discoveries in the Middle East, but they were made by Europeans who were looking for these and were curious about them scientifically. And in a sense that what happened in the Indus is similar. Maybe the local Indians, they knew about these ruins, but they never, you know, no one ever scientifically began to look at it or had the, you know, I wouldn't say the curiosity, but didn't have the infrastructure or the institutional history and to go and try to explore further what it all meant. But that's what happened in the 19th century, and this in the Indus was in the early 20th. And I think it was British, I think the British were building a railroad, I think is what it was in the Indus, and they discovered as they were digging, you know, these amazing city, 50,000 people, one of the largest cities ever that existed on the time that time on Earth. And they found a couple of them, and they had big water tank right in the middle of it. For they're not even sure exactly whether, even to this day, whether it was partly a ritual bath, but they also had very extensive plumbing networks, and they were clearly an agricultural society from other indicators.
And unfortunately, I think you tell us that the language which is found on some of what's been unearthed is undeciphered.
Yeah.
So certain questions we might have, at least for the time being, remain entirely unanswered.
Unanswered, at least in the linguistic form, yes. But we see patterns. You can look at the bones and you see malarial traces of malarial disease, which are often associated with irrigation societies because the standing water is very is a vector for mosquitoes, for malaria-bearing mosquitoes. Water is by far the number one source of human illness and disease. And we didn't discuss the sanitary revolution, but you know, Rome's aqueducts brought in so much clean, fresh water and flushed it away into the Tiber that civilization grew an urban society of 1 million people in the ancient times, which was unheard of because cities always have been places where people have more have died than have been able to survive. And in a sense, the history following Rome's fall bore that out once again with all the filth and disease keeping the city sizes very small until the 19th century when England in London started to have some terrible sewage problems because people started to move into the city was growing, and there was this great event called the Great Stink, where the Thames River began to really smell bad because all the sewage was just stagnating there. And they'd already suffered several cholera epidemics, killing, you know, 20,000-30,000 people at a shot. And the government was unable to mobilize itself to do anything about it. But when this Great Stink happened, it was right along the banks of the Parliament where the British legislators met. It was like as if the Potomac started to stink even more so because they were it's not even close to the capital as the Parliament is to the Thames. And the legislators were terrified because at that day and age, they believed that disease transmitted through the air, through miasmas, bad smells. And they thought they were going to get sick. It took them about a month to pass sweeping reform, sanitary reform, that not only cleaned up London, but spread around the world and became the linchpin of the public health revolution when we began to discover the germ theory of disease and how to cure, you know, antibacterial products and such, and was it one of the major transformations in human history. And it all spawned from you know, how do we get rid of the sanitation problem?
Amazing. One of the intriguing patterns that we see repeated over and over again is this cycle of a civilization arising someplace, and so often the presence of water or the utilization of technology to harness water will have so much to do with the rise of that particular civilization, and then comes with it a dramatic growth in population and ultimately depletion of those water resources, and then whether or not that civilization deals effectively with those kind of challenges will have everything to do with whether or not that civilization ultimately flourishes or perishes.
Yes.
I wonder, is it ever tricky for us to figure out sort of what is driving what? Is it the cart before the horse? Is, in some cases, does a civilization begin to decline for whatever reason, and one of the first things it loses the ability to do is to keep on top of this matter of water, or is the matter of water often the driving force in the decline? How do we unravel that particular question?
I'm not sure that that you can always do that. And I didn't try too hard in the book to do that because, you know, it could simplify, in a sense, the history. There are indicators. There are times when clearly things happen, like when the one of the major rivers would change its course and would lead to, like in China in the Han Dynasty, Han Empire, back at the just around 0 BC period. Or 0 AD, if you prefer. And clearly that society never quite recovered from that major event where the flooding of the Yellow, and then it moved some 500 miles away from the centers of civilization that had been built around it and left them high and dry. That was a kind of event that you can clearly say was an exogenous impact that the society couldn't handle. On the other hand, there are the events in the Islamic society, which, you know, was always a water deprived region and water scarce, but, you know, managed to develop a great trading empire on the base of these camel caravans that could transcend the deserts. But they had a few big irrigation regions. And when the Turks came in and took over, if you will, from the inside the Islamic society, these had been nomads. And it's a little speculative, but the indicators are that the historians who have written about it, that they were not quite as attentive to the maintenance of the irrigation systems. And so when there was a problem that emerged naturally from the from flooding or from irrigation canals get clogged up, they were not quite as attentive to repairing them. And that ultimately slowed their growth, if you will. It didn't lead to an immediate collapse, but they were overtaken then by other societies, notably Europe in that occasion.
Hmm. Before we turn our attention to the modern day, I want to touch on just a couple of other fascinating points made in your book. When you talk about Rome and the innovative ways in which they harnessed water and tapped into various water supplies, you talk about how they were particularly adept at exploiting water for the use of power, and then for utilizing water also in the development of something called concrete in 200 BC. I mean, that's one of the things I love about your book, is that we not only talk about the sort of obvious importance of water,
right,
but all the other ways in which water figures so prominently, if invisibly or imperceptibly, in what springs up in our various civilizations.
That's right. That goes to the question you raised before correctly. I mean, water, you know, mingles, as we say, with all things. This is why the importance of understanding this extraordinary molecule. It allows. It helps us create the things that not only build the society, but also to move water. So this concrete, which was a major invention of the Romans, required manipulating water itself in the production process. And when they were able to pour this liquid concrete, they could make build structures that were huge, large, and including the aqueducts to bring the waters to Rome, to build these great baths that kept the society not only clean, but became the central social institution of the Roman Empire. And it could not have been possible, probably, without the invention of this early form of concrete that allowed them to just simply pour into molds this liquid, and when it hardened, it was waterproof. I mean, it was an amazing invention.
Hmm.
And it was light.
One of the great stories told in your book is of the construction in the early 7th century AD of the Grand Canal in China, which really reshaped China and made possible the flourishing of a people that were otherwise confronted by a very difficult sort of topological conundrum mm-hmm. in terms of water being available to some and not to others.
Yes. The interesting thing about China and the Grand Canal, which was the completion, if you will, of canals that China had been building for centuries, actually, into about 200 or 300 BC, had always been important. China is the great water-moving civilization of world history. There's no question about it. America probably is second to China, and China has a long, long history with it. But the Grand Canal allowed the conundrum you're talking about is that there is a divide in China between the north and the south. If you want to think of the southwest of the United States as kind of a dry, you know, but fertile region, that is northern China, but multiplied by 10, a factor of 10. It is very dry. It is got great resources, and it's also the front lines of where the invasions used to come from the north, from the Mongols and people like that. And they always needed to have manpower up there to try to defend that region and to develop it. And every time they would be overrun, they didn't have enough army. They didn't have enough sufficient armies, frankly, in that region to and they couldn't sustain them because they couldn't produce the food. So what the Grand Canal did in its most rudimentary sense was allow all this rice from the south to be shipped in a very efficient manner, along with the troops, from the south to the north, and that protected society for several hundreds of years while they built a great empire. Eventually, the Mongols came in the form of Kublai Khan and established their own dynasty, but they were not; they were very much turned into Chinese, adopted Chinese civilization themselves. It took a couple hundred of years to do that. But so the Grand Canal was. It also allowed the first newspaper to be built to be published. The Chinese invented paper, of course, modern paper printing, of course, and they published a government newspaper that was then delivered along the Grand Canal. So you could just think about what a unifying factor that was, and this was way before Gutenberg, you know.
And of course, you also describe an amazing moment in world history and a mystifying moment in about 1433 when China, which was beginning to roam the seas of the world, ceased that activity right. and turned inward. And had they continued to expand their reach over the world's oceans, the planet on which we live and who we are and what we are might be completely different. I mean, your book touches on all kinds of intriguing questions and mysteries like this.
Yeah, there was a book written just on that topic about China. This was Cheng Ho, was the famous admiral, a eunuch, actually, a Muslim by religion, who was in charge of these giant treasure ships. They called them treasure ships, and they were much, much larger than anything that the Europeans or anybody else could put onto the seas. And they sailed all the way to Africa, stopping along countries and coasts, and they wanted all of the leaders of those societies simply to pay homage to the great emperor, the great Ming emperor in China. And if they did, they were bestowed with gifts. If they did not, they were seized and sometimes and shipped back to China for education until they understood that they should understood that the Chinese civilization was the greatest and mightiest, and indeed they were at the time. And then in 1433, as you say, the emperor gave an edict and said, "We will basically no longer several edicts. We will no longer." Go out into the seas anymore, into the oceans. We're going to seal ourselves up. But there's a strong xenophobic aspect to the Chinese society in any case because of all the invasions and for other reasons. But the one part of this book that this is a little speculative, but there are some historical Chinese historians that have alluded to it. So I'm not on going out on my own. But one of the mysteries, and I do try in the book to deal with several of the historic mysteries, if you will, and look at it through the water lens and speculate on them. But here is, why did China turn inward at that exact moment when it it controlled the oceans of the world. It could have controlled all the Indian Ocean. Could easily have sailed into the Atlantic Ocean and arrived in Europe, and Europe would have been unable to resist the power of China at that stage. And it did so because, in my mind, partly because they had just completed, after many years of building, a revitalized new Grand Canal. They revitalized it. It went all the way to Beijing. It solved some of the technical problems that they had about filling it with water in the drier seasons, and that gave them a secure inland route to provide all the supplies they needed from the south to the north. Previous to that, they'd had to sail along the coast, along the China Seas, and use the, which is a less reliable vehicle because of storms and because of pirates, to bring the goods that the North absolutely needed. So it is a more remarkable coincidence, in any event, between this completion of this inland network of transportation and China's decision ultimately to turn its back on the world and turn inward. And for 400 years, it kind of worked, but they fell behind the rest of the world, as societies almost always do when they fail to engage the most competitive aspects of human innovation.
And the rise of Western civilization then also circled around the matter of water, and literally circling in the form of, among other innovations, the water wheel.
Right.
And ultimately, in Europe, the development of power by steam. This is another really great example, I think, of something that we are so quick to dismiss and take for granted, and it is of tremendous importance and in terms of what arises and becomes possible.
This is one of the power generation, energy, if you will, is one of the four great uses that water has had in world history, although we're entering into a fifth era today. There's been water. There's been water for using for economic purposes. There's been water for domestic purposes like drinking, et cetera. There's been water for power generation, as we just said. And there's been water for transport purposes, like we were talking about before on the canals. Today we are facing the fact that we also need to put water back into the ecosystems themselves to preserve them so that they're healthy. But to come back to the power question, ever since, this is one of the great overlooked relationships, and it's really important. Water and energy should never be thought of as separate elements, separate problems. Since the water wheel, they have been co-joined. The water wheel simply harnesses the power of the flow of the rivers and turns it into mechanical energy. The Romans and everybody used it chiefly for grinding grain, that making the daily bread, which was for centuries and centuries the primary task, an essential task of societies. But the Europeans in the 13th century, following a bit some of the innovations made in China and Islamic society, but went farther than anybody else, began to apply it to industry, to early industry. And it was very useful even for heating up the bellows, for powering the bellows that would heat the iron, to produce the iron that we ultimately created many things with, many tools and such. The next sort of evolution of this after the water wheel was in England, as you say, was the invention of steam power, when we realized that steam could do far more work than the water wheel. And from that, there's a natural progressions that went back to the water wheel and actually began to invent the turbine that then ultimately became the basis of the hydroelectric power plants as the falling water from Niagara Falls and other places, rivers, became a source of power and energy. And as we said earlier, the 41% of U.S. water use today, withdrawals from rivers, is going to cooling thermoelectric plants. These are coal or other fossil fuel based or even nuclear power based power plants, but they use vast amounts of water. So what you see is that the water infrastructures and the energy infrastructures of our society are totally interlinked and have become increasingly so. And when we go forward and look at, you know, how do we answer our energy problems, you got to say, is there enough water? How is the water going to be used in this case? Because there are many places where the water shortages will constrain the amount of energy that you can produce. And I'll give you one example. China had a major plans for coal liquefaction plants up in the north, that very arid region I was describing about with so little water. But they have all their coal deposits there. But they had to abandon this major project in 2008 because they didn't have enough water to do the coal liquefaction, which is very water intensive.
Hmm. Your final chapter, of course, takes us to the present day and takes us inside the really troubling water shortage that is an increasing reality in so many parts of the world. And there are all kinds of illuminating stories. And one of them is about New York City and the way in which it has grappled with this issue actually for a long, long time. And you say, among other things, it is in the vanguard of the new soft path movement, which means what?
Well, you know, you can try to take the hard path is the traditional path. That is, you try to extract from nature the more and more water resources and force them to do what you want to do. The giant dams being the sort of the modern example of those. There is another path that says, let's try to use nature itself and other what we call other more efficient uses of water as we try to improve the productivity of the water that we are using. So one of the paths is let's look at what nature does. Nature does many things that we like. It cleans water naturally. It cleans the water of pollutants naturally. The ground filters it out. Wetlands filters these things out. What New York faced in a particular example was the EPA came in, the Environmental Protection Agency, and said, you guys have, your water's getting too dirty. You got to build a treatment plant. It's going to cost $8 billion. But you got to do it because people will get sick. New York looked at it and said, "Gosh, this is a lot of money." And they realized that if they spent $1 billion, they could purchase all the land or a lot of the land up around the reservoir systems that were getting so polluted, limit the development, retrofit some of the dairy farmers and others who were producing a lot of the pollutants. Obviously create a lot of nice amenities for the in forest land, which is also good for retaining water for recreational purposes, and pre-filter, if you will, through nature itself, the water before it entered the reservoirs. And in fact, this has been working for about 15 or more years now. It's been replicated throughout South America as in various places and other parts of the world as a model for the way that you can work with nature itself as a piece of the infrastructure, if you will. But you've got to assign a value to nature to do that. And the great movement today is, and this is the great hope, is that we will understand that nature is not just a dumping ground, but it has to have we have to ascribe an economic value to preserving it and to cleaning it if you do happen to pollute it. And if you begin to integrate it with a price, it will believe, at least I hope, and I believe it can be made to be integrated into the capitalist processes that have been so productive in terms of wealth production and in a sense, if you make the rule, I mean, my solution is that you got to create what we call what Adam Smith would have called maybe an invisible green hand. That is, you want to create the incentives for businesses and others who use the resources to have to pay for to build in the cost of cleaning up those the pollution that is generated in that process, so that it all gets integrated into the total price, and therefore the environmental costs will be reflected in the will be reflected in the final cost, and therefore will be used more efficiently. And we see that happening already in parts of the world that have adopted pollution regulations, including the United States. I mean, there is a remarkable thing has happened in our country that no one has really observed, and that is that from 1900 to 1975, our water use grew three times faster than our population. From 1975 to the present day, our total water use has flatlined, while our population has continued to grow by about 30%, and our GDP continued to grow. This is a fantastic increase in water productivity, and it occurs largely because we passed the Clean Water Act that said you have those industries to whom it was applied, you have to return the water to the ecosystem in the same clean condition that you took it out, and that essentially created a cost for that And the businesses react as business always does when there's a cost. They get really serious about it, and they get much more efficient. And they find ways of using less water, or they find ways of cleaning it that they weren't doing before. And it's that trend that we need to accelerate and to make ourselves even more productive. And we need to apply it to the agribusinesses who are not covered at all, and to some of the new pollutants that have come in that have not been regulated. If we do that, we'll end up, I think, becoming much more efficient in our growth and having more water available for the things that we want, to produce energy, to produce industrial goods, and frankly, to produce more food.
Mm. And of course, all of this that you are talking about now is so important, given the sobering reality that you also tell us about, involving what so many people hope is sort of the magic pill or the technological panacea, as I think you describe it at one point. Can't we just take all that water in the oceans and take the salt out of it? You tell us that as lovely as that solution might be, it is in fact a very complicated picture, and particularly in the short term, it is not something on which we can depend.
Right. Yeah, desalination might become the great new supply of water. No question that we have the capability to do it. It's still very expensive. It burns fossil fuels, which is bad for the climate change problems. And there's the problem of once you get the water onto once you've desalted it, you need to move it someplace. It's very expensive and heavy. Water weighs 8 1/3 pounds, 20% more than oil, and you need such large volumes of it to move that it is very energy intensive and very costly to do it. And so, therefore, it's of limited value to move it, you know, inland and over long distances, at least in the quantities you need. But the first thing is that desal. Prices have come down dramatically. The technology has improved. But even if you allow the best-case scenario, and that may come in the next number of years, because Israel and California, there are places, Singapore and Cyprus are doing some very cutting-edge work in the field, the amount of desalinized water is so tiny, the base is so tiny, and the build-out of these plants takes so many years that you're not going to solve the problem in the short or intermediate term, the next 20, 25 years at least. And we're going to face places around the world, like for example, in India, where they've been pumping groundwater to provide the food that they need, and they're now hitting bottom. I mean, you know, these places are out of water, and people need to eat tomorrow, and those countries need to hold together. The big danger today is, you know, these failed states, and desal might get there, but it's not there yet, and it's not, as you say, ready for prime time, right in the short time when we need it. The other topic I did want to just touch on briefly is the evolution of United States history, because you can look at, you know, if you want to look at this historical question of what makes looking at history through the lens of water unique, you know, our own country offers a very interesting example, because we really have three hydrological regions in the United States, and you could see that the conquest, if you will, the control, the harnessing of that water, that potential in each of those regions required different solutions, and when we did it, it led to enormous growth and really the rise of the United States. And I'm first talking about the eastern part of the United States, which is a rainy area with very fertile land and good agriculture. It has rivers that are navigable and were pretty high and good for generating water power. And we harnessed that very early on through the building of some factories. For example, you think of Lowell, Massachusetts, and the great textile factories. We were able to build the Erie Canal that linked the East Coast to through the Great Lakes, through all the way down to the Mississippi Valley, and managed to merge the resources of that, you know, the tremendous resources, agricultural resources of the Mississippi, with the eastern coast and the trading networks. And so that was one, you know, sort of a problem to solve, and the United States did that brilliantly, but our history could have ended right there. But the next region was sort of our seascapes, our both our trading and our naval power. And when we invented the Erie, the Panama Canal, or invented it, when we built it, against tremendous odds, the French had failed, had been unable to do it, and they were the very advanced society, you know, we suddenly linked our East Coast to our West Coast, and all of the resources that were available there were suddenly transportable by boat, and very inexpensively, and we had a great navy at that point, too, and were able to extend our reach globally. And then we were faced with the problem of the West, which was an arid region. And you look at the history, just from local politicians, local writers, as far as you know, is Frederick Jackson Turner was writing on the Frontier Thesis, and he was moaning about the problem of how do we deal with this West. That you just can't go and settle a small plot of land out there like we did in the East because there's no water. And he realized that it was going to have to be massive irrigation projects. And it took quite a while, but we got the Hoover Dam and the all the dams that followed it, producing both the hydropower and the irrigation. And that really launched our Western region. And today, I argue that we face a fourth challenge, and it's how to now use all the water resources that we've got in a way that is going to be more productive than we have, than we're using them today, to do it in a way that is going to be ecologically sustainable, so that our ecosystems have enough water in them to produce the volumes that we need for any kind of society. And you're beginning to see that. Groups getting together, even on the Klamath River just recently, they've gotten together. And sometimes you have to say, or the Great Lakes Compact. I mean, sometimes you have to say we have to take care of the ecosystem, but it means that everybody may have to use less of the water, but we're going to then therefore have incentives to use it more efficiently.
Right. And, of course, I'm speaking to you from just south of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Right.
And almost within view of Lake Michigan, one of those so-called Great Lakes. And, of course, the fact that this agreement was crafted between the bordering states of the Great Lakes to seek to protect this resource speaks volumes about how differently we view a resource like water now versus even 30 years ago.
Absolutely, and it's, of course, very controversial, and it also shows that the politics of water is coming to the United States. I mean, the Great Lakes Compact, which was ratified by Congress in 2008, essentially says we're going to work to clean up the Great Lakes, which is a great thing, but it also says we don't want that water is not to be exported outside of the basin, if I'm correct on that. And that's very understandable. It's a critical economic resource, as you say, and people beginning to recognize it. But it also shows that other parts of the country, like Texas, like New Mexico, et cetera, have their eye on every available water source, rather than doing the hard things that they should be doing, which is to live within their as much as possible anyway, live within their limitations of their ecosystems and the amount of water produced there by being more efficient. That's what's going to be starting to play out more and more. I mean, we just saw in the Southeast, for example, the state of Georgia, which was running short of water because of the drought, tried to move its state border 1 mile so that it would border the Tennessee River and could take water out of the Tennessee River. And then it tried to sue Alabama and Florida to get more water out of the rivers that they commonly share. I mean, you know, this was all in lieu of having built proper water infrastructures over the last 30 years. And so they were they were squeezed.
Mm. So this is hitting us close to home in more ways than one, and of the story will only become more important, and in a sense, your book will become only more valuable over time. The book is Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. It is published by HarperCollins. It includes photographs and illustrations and much more that we did not even get to touch on in the course of this lengthy conversation. Stephen Solomon, I so appreciate you crafting this important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show and being so generous with your time. I thank you most sincerely.
Well, I thank you very much for very wonderful questions and for the time you've allowed me.